Hey, everybody. It is 1:30 p.m. KST, Korean Standard Time. I'm in my living room. I'm a little bit hungover. Went out for drinks, got some soju. They got this new soju in Korea that is absolutely delicious that I would recommend if you ever come out here. The new Jinro soju. I don't know actually what the name of it is. Do you guys know what the name of the blue bottle? You guys don't know either? You just asked for the Jinro soju. It's delicious. If you like soju. So I'm sitting here. I'm in my underwear. I mean, I got a shirt on, okay? I mean, there's other people over here recording this, all right? I'm not a total pig. But a little bit hungover. I'm going to do this intro. This episode of the podcast was recorded, I think it was about 2 weeks ago. I had the chance to sit down and talk to Zombie Grub. She was out here for GSL versus the World. I was really excited to have her on. We had an awesome conversation. We talked about all sorts of stuff. Her history in gaming, her opinions about a lot of other older games, and what it's like to be a female in esports and in the gaming industry. I really enjoyed this episode. Before we get started, you guys are probably used to hearing this already, but if you can support me on Patreon, it's really appreciated. The money that we get there is getting reinvested back into the show. For instance, we might get to 100 Patreons already. We're going to get a camera when we do that. Other stuff in the future, I want to get additional mics so we can have like a nerd round table. You know what I'm saying? Like a couple of like imagine like the Avengers, but with nerds. And they're all sitting here saying smart shit. Well, we can eventually get to that if we get enough support on Patreon. Think of it like a Twitch sub or something like that, or a Twitch donation. And if you can't, it's no problem at all. If you can't do that, it would be great if you could tell a friend about the podcast or subscribe on YouTube or give a good review. Anything is really appreciated. So that's patreon.com/tastelesspodcast. And that does it for our intro. So let's go to that Zombie Grub interview. So you can't eat before a cast?
I mean, can't is a strong word, but I prefer not to.
I had this bakery. Well, I shouldn't say I didn't have the bakery. There was a bakery inside the studio for KSL, so I kept eating these really good pastries. And then 10 minutes into the cast, like Artosis is talking, I turn and look at him and have no idea what he had said because I'm in this food coma.
Food coma.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I actually find it's better if I almost don't eat anything.
Yeah.
If it's a long day, like a big event, to just not do like anything at all.
No, I agree.
And then eat at the end of the day.
Yeah. Like I'll just avoid eating breakfast. Yeah, most of the time. Even though I think it's going to be a really long day. So, but I also like, I'm like a bored eater, right? So
yeah.
Like I'm actually like the more that I'm doing something, I realize that my appetite's actually not what I think it is.
Yeah.
So like I can go like, 16 hours without eating if I'm just doing something and not feel too bad. But as soon as I'm like home alone doing nothing, it's like, it's been 2 hours since the last day, like time to eat again.
Do you ever have it where you've been playing games for so long, you have no idea that you haven't eaten or gone to the bathroom?
So the only time I've ever had that happen is like when I'm on a losing streak in StarCraft 2, I'll turn off the stream and then be like, I can't be this bad. And I'll like go back and play.
Yeah.
And then the second time was with World of Warcraft.
Just grinding?
Yeah.
I never got into World of Warcraft. I never got into MMOs. I don't know. I was talking to Melty and Ryan about this earlier. I don't know. I couldn't get into it. What drew you into World of Warcraft?
That's a good question. So initially I was playing Final Fantasy XI because I was a big fan of Final Fantasy.
That's the MMO one, right?
Right. That was the first MMO one. So I had to like ask my parents for like permission, it was so long ago and get their credit card. And I was playing that and I was super bad at it. I had no idea how to play it. We get into like a party and I'd be like, so we like get each other's like, friends list or something. They're going to party again. And it's like, no, that's not how it works. And then my brother got the beta to World of Warcraft. And we were all, big fans of Blizzard for a while. Excuse me.
We have the cat trying to drink Zombie Grub's water.
Yeah, I just
That's actually funny. He doesn't do that with anybody else. I don't know.
All right. It's just special.
Oh, you know what it is? I only drink out of the green cups for water. Everything else is tea or something else. So he's probably never seen water in one of those cups.
It's funny.
Anyway, sorry. What were you saying?
So we were all big fans of Blizzard. Just me and my brothers growing up. And especially because Blizzard games are like some of the only really good games that worked on Macintosh. It was the iFirst.
Okay. So that's a big difference. So
yeah.
You grew up in a house with Macs.
Yeah, actually, yeah. Our family computer was definitely a Macintosh, whatever. I don't even remember the year it was, and there was like Oregon Trail on it. And like that was our family computer. So, and then I wanted to be an artist. So like one of those like stereotypical things is that they tell you to get a Mac if you're going to be an artist. So I had that, and I always like reduced like the amount of video games I could play.
Yeah.
So I played Warcraft, and then I had N64 for StarCraft because I didn't know the difference. I
know
it was
so
better.
Crazy. So you started StarCraft on the Nintendo 64.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
A lot of people don't know that was actually on. They think it's a joke. Like
I know
when you see the picture. Because that would seem to be impossible, but actually, yeah, a lot of people started.
I mean, it is a meme, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. But we were, like, big console gamers, basically. And then my brothers were quite a bit older than I am, so they got PC setups because then they could play in their own room without our parents interrupting them. So I was the console gamer. So anyways, my brother gets World of Warcraft, and he's like, you should definitely play this. You can use my account, which is really nice of him. So I get into that, and then I play it very casually for like straight up like a year or two, probably just very casually. I have no idea what I'm doing. I think one gold is a lot, and it's not. And then my friends get into it. My like nerdy friends in like middle high school basically were all like, you know, I'm thinking about getting into it. So that kind of like jump-started the serious undertaking of World of Warcraft. So I was into World of Warcraft for, I mean, probably like 8 years, something like that. And at one point, I was even like a raid leader.
Oh, really?
I was in college, yeah. It was like dinky little raid group. So I was the leader. I was the only one that really knew what I was doing. It was a fun time, though, but I just never... The problem was that, you know, you imagine someone saying, I played World of Warcraft for 8 years. You know, you must be like, oh, you're pretty serious about it. And it's like, that was actually a problem for me. Like, my friends got super into it, and they would just out-level me. They would out-gear me, and I'd just be left behind. So that's actually what turned me off from MMOs for a super long time.
Did you feel like you were in a situation where every Blizzard game that came out, that was just what you gravitated to? Because I know that's what happened to me for most of my youth. It was like... I started on Warcraft 2, and then it was only logical I'd then go to Diablo when that came out. Mm. And from there, it was StarCraft. And did you have a similar thing?
No, not really. Like, I never got into the Diablo stuff. Like, a ton of my, you know, my peers have. I was never a Diablo fan. So it was just this, like, perfect order of events where we got the N64, picked up Smash, picked up StarCraft for whatever reason. I mean, I guess I have to ask my brothers why they picked that up. And then Warcraft was the game I could play on Macintosh. So I played that. And then when StarCraft 2 came out, my brothers were actually like, oh, are you going to play that? I remember playing it. And I was like, I guess. But it was all because I was into Blizzard because of World of Warcraft, really. And that was it.
What other games were on Mac back then? I'm trying to remember. I remember going to, like, I think it was called CompUSA. It's not around anymore. But and then looking at the different games. Because there was a period where I think my mom... Because I was at the whims of my mom and what PC she was going to pick. I thought right. There was, for a little bit, some debate on getting a Mac. And I remember being sort of panicked when I was finding out that all the other games couldn't be played on there. Were there Sierra games?
I believe there were.
These are like the King's Quest.
Yeah, but I didn't play that Sierra game. There's another Sierra game that I played because I remember the logo.
Was it one of those point and click?
No, it wasn't a point and click. You know, it might have been an
Incredible
RTS.
Machine or...
Was it an RTS or a city builder?
Okay. Yeah,
yeah, I feel
they made a lot of games.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, that was like one of the like, you know, nostalgic like 90s companies was Sierra. So I must have played some games there, but really I was just a console gamer. Like, I identified as a console gamer and a PlayStation fan for so long. It wasn't really until, I would say, even when I was playing World of Warcraft, I didn't really consider myself a PC gamer. My brothers would buy all these other games on PC, and I would just basically have the one or two with Warcraft. And then otherwise, I was playing console because I was a huge fan of the Final Fantasy series and JRPGs.
Which one did you start on?
So technically, I started on Final Fantasy X. It came out on the PS2. It was a big deal. But
that was
your
first one?
That's the first one I played. I watched my brothers play.
I feel so old right now. Okay.
I watched my brothers play 8 and 7 at one point, too. But then the one that actually got me, like, really invested in the Final Fantasy and also, like I don't want to make it all about, like, you know, I was going to say I don't want to make this podcast all about me, but I guess that's the point.
Yeah, yeah. I'm like, make no mistakes. This podcast is all about me, actually. No, please, go ahead. I'm really curious.
Final Fantasy VIII was what really got me into not just video games and Final Fantasy, but also, like, reading. So... You know, my parents never really minded that we played video games, especially me, because I was a very good student. And one of the reasons I was a really good student is because I learned to read and type so much better than anyone else in my grade, because I played a bunch of video games that required nothing but either typing or reading. So when I played Final Fantasy VIII, it just like opened this whole new world for me. And that's why, like, you know, people always be like, why do you like Final Fantasy VIII so much? And besides actually liking the game.
Most people tend to lean towards 7 as the big one that they like from that era.
Yeah, I know. I actually, like, 7's like one of my least favorite, but it's out there.
The first Final Fantasy I played was Final Fantasy I.
I mean, that makes sense.
I had a friend come over. It was on Nintendo. And it's so funny because it's almost impossible to go back and play like Final Fantasy I now. I know they have it remastered, but it's just, it's really grindy and the story is almost non-existent.
Yeah.
But I was so into it at the time. It totally blew my mind that you could have like different characters with different armors and weapons and spells, and you're trying to build your character up and level up. It was crazy to me. And then I remember being a really little kid. I think I might have brought this up in other podcasts. I had this friend who I went to school with, and he was in one of those houses where the parents were like never there.
Okay.
You know what I'm talking about?
Sure, yeah.
He had like several siblings, and so it was sort of chaotic, and there was lots of video games. And I would go over to his house for sleepovers, and he had a much older brother. Like, the guy was in high school. I was in elementary school. Mm-hmm. His older brother was in high school. And I watched him play Final Fantasy VII, and I was completely blown away at the storytelling that they had gotten to.
Yeah, for me, it was 8 and the cinematics for 8, because that was the first time they really had that full motion video stuff. That was the first time they used motion actors, motion capture. So, did you watch G4 TV?
Yeah, I did. I actually would come home every day from school. I was always angry. Just wait, to go back, G4 TV was supposed to be the gamer TV station in North America, but they it was a very odd thing. They always tried to not make it about gaming. A lot of times it was about tech, or they had that, what's it called? Attack of the Show was on there.
Yeah. So originally it was, I don't even remember what it was called. It was like Tech TV, or literally that's what it was.
Yeah.
So then they combined with G4 to make G4 TV, which eventually became just G4. And it was this whole thing. But anyways, they had this show called Icons, which was like this really awesome show. It was 30 minutes long, and it was just the history of different video games and like prominent figures in video games. And that's like what spurred my interest in like the history of video games. They had one on Final Fantasy, and they had like, you know, all the discussions of like every single Final Fantasy, why it was a big deal, why 7 was a big deal, why 6 was known as 3, right, in America, and all that good stuff.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Maybe they brought this up there. It was called Final Fantasy because they thought they were going to go bankrupt.
Exactly.
With the first one that was coming out.
Yeah. Exactly. They made a racing game, and they made a couple other like really like, you know, lame games that had no. They didn't really make games for their company, Squaresoft, right, at the time. And then they were like, well, we're not making any games from these other guys giving us money, so we're just going to make our last game. And that's why it was called Final Fantasy.
And then I think with Final Fantasy III in the States, but it was 6 in...
Right, it was 6 in
Japan, because they didn't release the other Final Fantasies.
Yeah.
There was this weird thing in the Japanese market where they were constantly convinced that Americans did not want difficult games.
Yeah.
And it was a very odd thing, but yeah, we have to water this down or simplify this, because there's no way it would sell in the States.
Which is so weird, because like I don't really think of the JRPGs as that difficult. I mean, they're grindy, right?
Right.
But like, I would never say that they're difficult.
I'm wondering why they didn't release the other Final Fantasies out then. Although, I'm trying to remember, Final Fantasy I on Nintendo was not an immediate big boom success, is that correct?
No, it wasn't, no.
It was later on people caught on to it, because there was actually, at that time on Nintendo games, there was like tons of games. It was really easy to quickly program games, so you had this like market confusion where
nobody
knew what, you go to like Blockbuster with your mom to rent a game, and there's like 200 games, you have no idea which one to pick out.
That was actually kind of like one of the infamous stories of the E.T. video game. Did you ever hear about that? Yeah, that's like literal like landfills just of this game that sold so poorly. And because it was a bad game, but also because the market was super oversaturated.
And that guy was forced to make that game in 6 days. There's a documentary about that on Netflix, about the E.T. game.
Oh,
that guy actually quit becoming a coder and then became a therapist. He was so traumatized by being made fun of for the game. That was like the first, I guess, major game that flopped. And this is back when all these gaming magazines would write these snarky reviews.
Yeah.
And so he ended up becoming a therapist, and he works in Silicon Valley now.
Oh, I mean, that's kind of, that's a good ending.
Yeah, it's a happy ending. Yeah.
Yeah. But that was actually like, that's one of the things, is that this was kind of alongside one of the bubble bursts of video games, right? Because initially it was considered a joke. No one really wanted to buy it. Well, I guess like very initially it was kind of a cool idea. It took the arcade home and that was a cool idea, but then it just like kind of flopped. Then Nintendo revitalized it for a little while, and then the ET thing happened, and that was along the side of a big another flop. And I mean, when you get into like the actual, I feel like the impactful like consoles of, you know, at least America, it was kind of the PS1 N64 era, right? So like when I started getting into video games, really,
I think a little bit before that, there was this weird thing that happened where there was actually a bunch of consoles that came out at once. I think I must have been, I'm a little bit older than you. I'm sorry, how old are you, Zombie Grub?
28.
Okay, I'm 35, so I got a couple years in you. I remember, I want to say it was like I was in middle school or in sixth grade, but there was this whole period where there was like the Atari Jaguar was a console. There was Neo Geo. There was a whole bunch of handheld ones. And they all collectively bombed.
Yeah.
And things slowed down. Then eventually Sony and Sega, it was the PlayStation and the Sega Saturn.
Right.
Came
right.
out. And then there was a Nintendo 64. Saturn bombed out. Sega yeah. tried one more time with Dreamcast, which was actually pretty good, but it apparently could pirate the games.
Yeah, well, it also came out around the same time as, like, it literally came out before PS2, like, very shortly before.
Yeah, that's right.
So PS2 could play DVDs, and Dreamcast couldn't. So, like, that already kind of, like, you know, stamped the death certificate on it. But I love the Dreamcast. It had such amazing games. But, yeah,
that was, like, one of the best consoles ever. I've always found consoles that didn't make it, but had some good games to be totally fascinating. Because you have these games that just can't be played. It's like a dead language or something. Like poetry in a dead language.
Like
nobody
Latin.
Can read. Yeah, yeah. Where it's there. Like, I had a Sega Saturn, and there was this really good RPG that actually inspired a whole chain of other RPGs called Panzer Dragoon Saga. And there's almost no copies of it in English. And I played it. It was like 3 or 4 CDs long. But yeah, I mean, it's like impossible to find anybody to even talk about the game. Because it was just, it was so obscure. I don't believe it was ever remade or put anywhere. But yeah, there's a lot of stuff that kind of goes away in situations like that. So you grew up playing Japanese RPGs. Do you still play Japanese RPGs? Because right now, JRPGs are actually not doing as well in the global market.
I do not really play them. I mean, when I played StarCraft 2, I mean, even before I played StarCraft 2, I was basically just playing World of Warcraft. So I was like a one video game person for quite some time, except for Final Fantasies. But the thing that happened with Final Fantasies is that Enix came in and joined up with Square, and it just kind of like nose bombed for me since then. 13 came out, and it was just like, oh, I don't want to play these video games.
I played that one, and I got a little bit far into it, and it's like they got too into the leveling up system. It got too.
Yeah, there's that.
The storylines. Okay, I'm going to throw this theory out here. This has always been my take on it. So the older Japanese RPGs, they were more cutesy with the animation. You know, Final Fantasy VII. Cloud looks like he has brooms for hands. But I could take my own imagination and sort of project what the world was like and what the characters were like. And there was something weird that happened to me. And I remember it happening in Final Fantasy 13, where it was almost too anime-like
and
too Japanese-ish, like just in the way the characters behaved, which as a Westerner for me, I didn't connect with. And I just thought, oh, I don't know. And I've talked to other people about this, and they've had similar experiences where I felt more in tune with Western RPGs once it got cinematic enough and there was enough dialogue.
Yeah. Well, I think just generally like RPGs of Western companies got much, much better. But also, I think this happened not just for video games, but also for like anime, which obviously have a lot of crossover for JRPGs. So the other thing is that when I was growing up, I was a really big like Japanese anime like fanatic, like a weeaboo would be a correct term for me for a few years there. And you know, there's the whole like, you know, funny line from Miyazaki's like anime was a mistake, right? Well, the thing is, you look at like old anime, like, you know, like really old, like 70s,
you're talking like Akira or
old, like 70s or even like somewhat old, like 90s, so right. But you look at it and it's like very little of it is what we identify as anime right now, right? Which you identify as anime right now. It's like big eyes, you know, kind of crudely drawn, but definitely with the, what's the word? Like the repetitive storylines and all the cliches that exist. Like you just have to actually avoid them almost in anime. So you want to like, you know, someone's like, I recommend this anime. I'm like, well, how anime is it?
Yeah, I grew up on, I think it's the three big ones for me were Akira, Ghost in the Shell, and Ninja Scroll.
Yeah. Those are all like super mature and just not anime
yeah.
as
yeah,
we know.
Yeah, they
it.
Were very like adult oriented. Like yeah. these are just actually not for kids.
Yeah.
I mean, I saw them when I was like a teenager.
Yeah. yeah.
But I mean, I was like, wow, I actually had this horrible experience where I thought my mom wasn't going to come back for the evening. So I was in the living room watching Ninja Scroll.
Mm-hmm.
And she walked in on that rape scene
oh, no.
in the cartoon. And she just stops. She looks at me. She goes, what are you watching? And I'm like, a movie. And she goes, what are you watching? And I had to stop. I'm like, Liz, it's a movie. It's a movie. Okay, it has a story. There's just a scene in it. It's
yeah.
a totally awkward, embarrassing teenage moment. But yeah, there was a lot more adult-themed
yeah.
Stuff. And I feel like anime, a lot of ways, kind of veered away from that.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a medium, you know, and you can still say that it's a medium. It doesn't have to be the anime stereotypes that you think of. But back then, it felt like either it was like a medium that was used to express a story or something like that, or it was what the Japanese really knew it as, which is cartoons, right? Yeah. So you had your Sailor Moon versus your Akira, vastly different things. But the point is, like, neither one of them really shared all the cliches of, you know, what you think of anime now. The reason I bring this up is that it kind of like it intertwined with all these games coming from Japan, it felt like, right? Where like the more you watch Final Fantasy's progression and the art director, Tetsuo Nomura, who eventually became like game directors, he just got more and more of like anime influence until, you know, 10 had a couple of extra buckles and looked kind of funky and you're like kind of laughing. And then,
yeah, 10 was right on the edge.
Yes, exactly.
I felt where I'm like, okay, this is getting a little bit too...
Yeah.
I don't know, teeny bopper anime, kind of.
No, absolutely.
The love story, the guy's always immature
yeah.
and kind of can't, I don't know. And
yeah. And then they went to 11, which is MMO, and then they went to 12, which was a huge throwback to the original Final Fantasies. It was super serious. It was super intellectual dialogue. I mean, it was fantastic, but it was a little boring. And despite getting amazing reviews, I think it didn't really hit the market that Final Fantasy was really hitting at the time, which was a lot of young women in particular. So they went back, they just like basically flipped the switch from 12 being what it was to 13. When 13 is the worst, the epitome of that anime.
Yeah, I had
stuff.
To turn it off when yes. I got it. I really kept giving those Final Fantasies a try every time. And then, I don't know, there was I could not gel with the characters.
No, I couldn't either. I mean, the dialogue was just, I tried replaying it. You know, because I didn't like the combat, I didn't like the characters, I didn't like the dialogue, I didn't like the story in general. And I was like, I'll give it another go, I should. And then I was like, 5 minutes in, the dialogue like hit me like a hammer, and I was like, oh, never mind, I don't want to play this.
So do you play any, like, I guess, Western RPGs? I know they're
yeah, yeah.
played, like, Fallout, that franchise, or the...
So I was a big BioWare fan.
Okay.
Yeah, I guess up until recently, like most other people. So I was really into Mass Effect. It's like still one of my favorite series for sure. And then other than that, I really play other, like, I didn't really get into Fallout. I wasn't really into the Skyrim Morrowind stuff.
I was super into Fallout.
I mean, I played it. I finally played a Fallout and it was fun.
Which one did you play?
4.
Oh, man. You gotta play New Vegas. That's the best one.
That's what everyone says, right? So I mean, I understand why it's appealing. I just, like, even, you know, people always say, like, as I got older, I play less video games. I actually started pretty young, just not really playing a whole ton of video games. But I still played enough, especially casually, that people would be like, remember that one game we played on Sega? And I'd be like, oh, yeah, totally. But, yeah, I'm kind of, like, down to, like, a 1, maybe 2 video game player now. And a lot of that, actually, wasn't necessarily because I wanted to, but because my physical health actually degenerated pretty early in my life.
Can I ask what happened?
Yeah, so when I was, let's see, like, I was 20. I think it was 2021. I actually started getting wrist problems, which is really early compared to what you usually hear. And it wasn't like I was a pro gamer, you know, practicing
you
14 hours.
You were getting it from just using your hands?
Yeah, just using my hands. You know, I played World of Warcraft for hours at a time, and it wasn't healthy, to be fair, but it was one of those things where I would witness my other people up until even like now, they'll be like 28 and they'll have these bad postures and they'll play all these video games and not take breaks, but they're actually still fine. And it's like, well, that will eventually catch up to you. But for me, it just happened really early. So by the time I was like 20, I was already considering not playing video games just because it would start to hurt. So I had to go through a whole slew of things to figure out exactly what was causing that problem. But it still exists today where just the idea of sitting down and playing video games for even like a couple hours at a time is like a serious consideration for me, instead of just a fun thing to do.
How did you recover?
So initially it was diagnosed as repetitive stress injury. And they also were like worried it'd be carpal tunnel because that's kind of like the buzzword. Went to a couple of bad physical therapists that didn't really help. They kind of just massaged like the forearm because that's where the symptoms were. And then I went to a Lotte mall in America. There was actually a grocery store because I live near a Koreatown where I live. And there was this guy who was a massage parlor in that grocery store. And he was one of those just like, you know, he's like a guru, basically. Like, this guy knew everything and was so smart. And he knew exactly what my problem was. He gave me one massage and he was like, the problem is not your wrists. It's your neck. And I was like, whoa, okay. And he did, you know, a couple of things here and there. And it just felt amazing. So I went to another physical therapist finally. And they were like, yeah, no, it's totally your neck. Like, the way that you're slouching and the way that your posture is. I even got a scan done to see my spine, and it turns out like I didn't have like a bend in a spine.
I've had those scans. And
yeah, you know how like your spine is supposed to have these curves to kind of just let you like relax,
right?
And it just kind of helps keep all your organs together, basically. Well, apparently, like right like around the base of my neck, it didn't really curve as much as it's supposed to. So I even went to like a chiropractor for a little while. But anyways, basically, it was my neck. So as soon as I started actually stretching my neck and doing things there, it, you know, eventually just got down to my wrists, and that's not, you know, so much a problem anymore. I don't get pain in my wrists anymore, but it's just something I always think about. And I just like, it actually kind of scares me to like play video games for extended periods of times, but it was so, you know, when you're having your wrist problems,
I just played some StarCraft before we started this, and it feels so good to be back. But
yeah,
once you get stuck and your hands aren't working, you're fucked. Because like, you can't use your hands for anything.
No,
you use your hands
terrible
all the time as a human being.
Yeah.
So everything suddenly becomes a problem.
Yeah, and it's like if I spend 2 hours playing a video game, then I'm not going to spend 2 hours, you know, doing something else on the computer, which is basically everything nowadays. You know,
right.
Your homework's on your computer. I want to be an artist, so I was doing a lot of 3D modeling. And you just went through an entire period, like 3 years of my life or something like that, before I truly healed from it, where I was just like, every time I considered going to the computer was this huge, like, well, should I thing.
Wow.
Very annoying.
So, when did you really pick up StarCraft? Was it a StarCraft 1 thing, or was it StarCraft 2 when that came out?
StarCraft 2, for sure.
Okay.
I just played StarCraft 1 in the campaign, I guess. I must have bought the collector's edition at some point, but just played the campaign, and StarCraft 2 came out, and I played it, and I looked up some videos on like how to get better, because I wanted to beat my brother, who always won when we were younger. And then I found like this thing called esports, and I found out these Koreans are really good at this game. And I got totally hooked on just watching so many YouTube casts. That was like the nostalgia days, I guess.
Yeah, it was crazy right when the game came out how big it got.
Mm-hmm.
Because StarCraft 1 was always, it was like sort of known, if you're like a hardcore gaming person, you were aware of this whole esports thing going on in Asia, but the States was always dominated by Counter-Strike and Quake and a lot of other games. So it was kind of crazy when the StarCraft 2 boom hit. So did you start watching, was that then Husky in HD and casts like that on YouTube?
No, I actually started off watching this guy called Force Strategy. He's still a YouTuber. He just doesn't do StarCraft anymore.
I don't think I've ever heard of him.
Yeah. You know, it was actually quite influential, though, because it wasn't just watching his videos and, like, his build order tutorials. It was also, he had a clan in StarCraft 2. And we remember that in StarCraft 2, when it first came out, you just really couldn't find anyone. You know, the chat system really sucked. The clan system pretty much
didn't invite anyone. Interface was actually made by the Xbox Live people. The Battle.net whole... So there was... The original StarCraft had this whole, it was like almost like IRC for the people that are older. It was like very easy to move through chat rooms and channels,
right,
and make groups. And then I guess Blizzard hired the Xbox Live people. And of course, when you're on Xbox Live, you're using a controller to interface.
Mm-hmm.
And so the thing was all boxy and weird, and it was very hard to actually just connect directly with somebody. I mean, they've eventually fixed it, and
right,
it's obviously much more doable now, but at the time it was very hard to find the right people to train with.
Yeah, and it was also like, you know, already a 1v1 game, so there's just the experience of StarCraft was quite a lonely one if you didn't manage to find a group. But luckily at the time, like now it might be Discord is where you find groups of people to play with, but at the time you basically just joined the chat channel of a famous YouTuber, because Twitch also was still kind of in development back then.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I joined Force Strategy Gaming chat channel and was able to make a bunch of friends there and meet some other people that were interested in getting better. Because that was, you know, it was almost like a mini day nine in some ways, where like the goal was to be a better gamer.
Right.
But
right.
Obviously it was a different brand. So that kind of like launched me into finding like clans. Like I was actually part of the PMS H2O clan. Do you remember that?
I do remember them. Yeah.
Yeah. I was always like one of the better players of those groups, which kind of like spurred my competitiveness. Cause PMS
was only women, correct?
Right. And their brother clan was H2O.
Okay.
So you would join you would join both of them. And, you know, back then also like watching, like OBS battle, like, 1v1 OBS. It was like a hugely popular arcade game for the time. Now I don't think it is anymore, but like you'd join in and you'd be a platinum player with all your other like platinum player friends, and then a masters player would join the lobby and you'd be like, oh my God, we're going to learn so much, you guys. Of course, you know, now you realize it's maybe not like the biggest deal, but at the time it was huge.
But this is a little bit before Twitch was
really
a thing. I mean, I had this similar thing when I was trying to figure out who's good in StarCraft 1, you know, because you had to get into a lobby. We had the old Battle.net, so it was easy to get into the channel. But then to get the player who's high-ranked, basically a Masters player, to let you watch them.
Mm-hmm.
And this is also before there was replays. So my brother and me would be scrambling to try to write down what we think the order of the buildings are to then figure out if we can test run it.
Yeah, yeah. I found a Brood War group. So there was like in my area, so I live in the DC area, and like the kind of time that like my clans online were kind of dying out, I was able to find that there was one like in real life that used a PC bong like in America as a pretty regular tournament. So I finally got the courage to go down there, and like I was the only woman, but they were pretty friendly. And turns out like all these guys are basically just like Brood War elitists in disguise.
Oh yeah.
Like they played StarCraft 2, but they also really wanted to play Brood War. So the first thing they took it upon themselves to do was to teach me Brood War and like the history of Brood War. So I learned all about that initial like catastrophe that was trying to watch games and trying to find games.
Yeah.
And, like how much of a no-no it was to give out your replays.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. I just found it all fascinating. So I got into Brood War through that, like 2012.
So when you joined PMS, that was, I want to say that was one of the first girl-only teams, women-only teams.
Yeah, Must be. Because I think like Livy, or not Livy B, Liv and Pink and them were like on that as well. Yeah.
What motivated you to try to join that team? Or was it because it was a group of women? Or was it just like that's where you got offered, or what is that whole experience like? Because I wanted to pick your brain on women in gaming in general, and especially in competitive play, it is still very male dominated. So how did you end up getting on PMS, and was that helpful being on a women's only team?
That's a very good question. I really don't remember it. I must have seen it like advertised somewhere on a YouTube video. I must have just clicked the link and like figured it out, because I don't really remember having such like a strong connection with it compared to like Force Strategy, where I met a lot of my friends, which we would continue playing StarCraft for a couple years even after they really stopped being interested in it. So I don't really remember why I got into it, and because the chat channel was also both, it was the guy and the girls stuff, I never got into the competition. It was never competitive.
So you weren't going to tournaments or...
No. I mean, at the time, I wasn't really interested in being competitive. And then at some point, kind of late 2011, probably after PMS H2O was done, like I really got interested in it and became Masters. I think like the one tournament I joined, I think I actually lost to Livy B, I think, in like 2011. And I was still like Diamond. So I don't remember how I got into that, but it didn't really... I'd already made other women friends in other channels, actually. So,
do you feel like it is you're discouraged culturally to try to learn games?
I think,
at least growing up, I guess now it's a totally different thing because
you're in a
community of people that. Oh, go ahead, please.
Yeah, so even then, like it's actually kind of funny. People ask me, like, you know, do you think it's, you know, bad right now? And I have to tell them straight up that I'm in a very unique situation. I already basically like went, I swam through all the shit that is like all these guys demanding that I prove themselves, prove myself to them. And now I'm sitting kind of at like the top where like people know Zombie Grub and other people will defend me. But back then it was absolutely just a sea of shit that would try and keep, I wouldn't like keep us down, but like that it just would happen so naturally. As soon as someone learned in that 1v1 OBS arcade game that you were a girl and your friend was a girl, I mean, it just, it instantly started, you know, there was like, wow, for a girl, you're really good. And it's like, oh,
so was that experience, more of an online experience, or did you get it a lot in real life?
I didn't really get it so much in real life. So then that's what seems to happen is that there's these unique, you know, pockets of girls usually who don't really have so much of the social effects against them, right? So a lot of times I'll talk to other women and their dads will immediately just disapprove. Whereas my dad was actually, like, he approved of my video game habits. He tried to make me, like, very competitive, which is another thing that happens with women, right, is they can be competitive in, like, cheerleading. And that's, like, actually what their parents will try and
beauty
and
pageants,
steer them towards.
Weird, yeah, stuff,
yeah. And I actually grew up in an area that was kind of like stereotypical like that. We moved from an area that was not like, you know, beauty pageant area into an area that was absolutely, if you're a girl, you're wearing dresses, you're hanging
was
out with
in,
the girls.
I'm sorry, were you in Virginia then?
Yeah, so now I'm from Virginia.
Okay.
And
okay.
I moved from Maryland. So I moved to this this place that was at the time not very developed, and it was just all, I mean, like Stepford Wives type thing, right? Like the woman yeah. all stayed at home and they raised their daughters in dresses. So at one point, you know, my vice principal actually called in my mom to talk to her about me because I was a total tomboy. You know, my mom would actually make me my clothes and it'd be like Power Ranger stuff because that's what I was into. And I was hanging out with the boys and, you know, the vice principal was like, well, we're just worried that, you know, little Jessica might just grow up to be, you know, and the suggestion was that I'd grow up to be like a lesbian, I guess.
Yeah.
And my mom was just like,
they got to get in there and stop that.
Yeah, right. So my mom just like, and she was also this other great role model that I had. She always worked. Her mom always worked. And she just like would not take any of that shit. So as soon as she would like talked about that or like that I didn't wear dresses and I should be playing with the girls more, my mom was just like, you pay attention to your kid and I'll pay attention to mine. Like, you know, shut the fuck up basically. And just like stormed out. And I think that is a unique experience. I can think of all the other girls that I was friends with in those years. This was elementary school and middle school. And so many of them grew up, just thinking that like they had to do this one thing and not be competitive and get into makeup and all that stuff. And luckily, I mean, my family was very supportive, and then I also found another, you know, four or five other girls who were also very much like tomboys, not video games, but, you know, books or whatever they were. So I think I had a very unique experience coming in, and I'm in a unique position now, but when I generally look around, it's definitely all these effects that just make you like, maybe I don't get into video games.
So I guess you have two different parts here, because there's the people that play games culturally that for some reason are threatened by women or don't think women belong there. And then there's also the kind of general culture you grow up in. Like I grew up in Kansas, in a suburb in Kansas City. And I mean, that's a place where anytime you go out, if you're not in work attire, you're in like the attire of your favorite sports team. You're in a Kansas City Royals shirt. You're wearing a Chiefs outfit. And it's just a place where they are obsessed with sports. And so even though there were some good gamers there, gaming was definitely sort of on the outside as far as like what mainstream people in Kansas City were doing. So I felt really discouraged by that. But I found that once I was able to find my niche online, it was much easier for me to excel and kind of cultivate my skill. But you found online there was still more pushback. Was that worse and was that different in a way?
It was actually pretty much similar to my experience with sports. As I said, my dad really pushed me to play sports, and that included male-dominated ones like football and rugby. And it was basically the same thing. Like, as soon as you proved to one or two of the guys that were influential, they'd been there the longest, they were the coolest, you know, whatever, the rest would accept you. And that's kind of what happened online as well. Like, you know, it wasn't even that you could prove yourself by being really good in my experience. Oh, that did sometimes help. But more often than not, you got the whole like, oh, you're good for a girl. And then they tap out and you're like, well, all right. It was, okay, I proved myself to this one or two guys. I got the validation of the big YouTuber guy, you know, once. And now I'm cool in everyone's eyes is kind of what usually happens. And that's what happened when I first did, you know, commentary. Is I did one big gig and then kind of had to convince everyone that I was cool. And then notably the amount of like, who is this chick? What is she doing here? What is she playing video games for? You know, all this other stuff stops.
Where do you think that suspicion comes from? Because I've always been kind of fascinated by this. Like I grew up playing games with my cousins. Almost all my cousins were girls. We'd play King's Quest and other games like that. I don't know. I mean, growing up, my first girlfriend, we would play console games together. So I was always sort of comfortable with the idea of women playing games. And to be honest, I always wanted to have a girl to play a game with because I went to all-boy Catholic school. You know what I mean? So women were like a total mystery to me until I got to college. But I've always been intrigued by this weird suspicion that some guys have about like, who is she? What is she? What are her motivations? What does she really want? Is she really good? Because it's very odd because you don't have this with other guys. I mean, it is interesting that and again, I don't think it's for all men, but there are some men who are either threatened or suspicious. Maybe they're of the belief that there's no way a woman could like this. And so you're some kind of an interloper.
Yeah, I don't think I can really answer that. You know, I think that goes actually a lot into like sociology and all that. Like just the idea of having our spaces, you know, it isn't always like a gender to gender thing. Sometimes it really is like an age to age thing. Like, you know, if you're in a knitting and you go into a knitting circle of like 50-year-old woman and you're a 20-year-old woman, that's already a little weird. If you're a 20-year-old guy, that's super weird. But just like having our like spaces and seeing it as like, yeah, people who intrude. I think for video games in particular, there's that whole idea that a lot of people who play video games, less so now, but you know, in the 90s and early 2000s, is that you were the guy who was an outcast. You weren't the guy who played sports. You weren't the cool guy. So you found your little group, and then someone that you didn't recognize to be in the same problem, I guess, like having the same problem, tried to come in, which is really weird because you would think that people who would know what it's like to be ostracized for your interests would be the nicest group to go into. But it's almost like sometimes like a very drastic opposite effect where because you went through all that shit of being made fun of because you were the guy who was into video games, you also are now a little more on guard against the woman who's into it. And it's just like, where does it start exactly? I have no idea.
I've also seen this, I think this has happened a little bit more with the internet and people being able to insulate themselves. Even though the internet opens up the world in a way, it also allows you to insulate yourself from a lot of stuff. Because I've seen this with both men and women where they really seem to be totally baffled by the other gender in a way that I think we never really had before.
Yeah. I think back to like the amount, you know, I whenever I talk to people who are like, no, like I was never affected by society, and like you'll actually talk to people who just think that they're just not affected by that they're free thinkers,
that they're not products of their environment or something.
Yeah, exactly. And you're just like, you know, like you don't want to be, but all of us are to a degree because we all start in a society when we're like it was 0 years old. And I'm thinking about reading of like this really popular series I really love called Wheel of Time. But even from the get-go, if you read that when you're a kid, like 13 years old, in the 90s, it is literally that. It is like the woman on one side of the book and the men on the other side, and basically all their jabs to each other are like men doing men things, and then they like walk off and do something else. And it's not too hard to see how much like that can be ingrained, like right, subconsciously, of course. But I don't want to try and like explain.
You know, well, I mean, it's a big undertaking. I mean, this is a whole fascinating thing because I think, you know, now esports is gone from being, at least when I was younger, it was completely obscure.
Right.
Right. I mean, it would require, you know, a half hour of explaining to even try to get the legitimacy of it across. You know, and then you have to explain, okay, now here's what they're doing in the game. They're actually doing all these strategies, and this takes a lot of practice, and there's all these different regions of the world fighting. Now esports has suddenly really become quite mainstream. Yeah. I feel like I'm at the point where if I say esports, people actually, for the most part, tend to know it.
Right.
If they're sort of up to date with anything cultural.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel that it is still hard for women to find a place in gaming or in streaming or in casting or in esports.
Yeah.
In general.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, like, it is kind of weird because I sit atop this throne where I'm mostly just considered chill and no one really thinks of me. Well, I can't say no one does, but a lot of people don't think of me as a woman. I am just this other commentator that does things. But when I look at other things that happen in our community, StarCraft community, which is one of the better ones, or even just like on Twitch, you know, it's absolutely the case. Like, I mean, we recently had a huge, like, disappointing scandal, right? Where, like, some girl was just harassed by one of our famous streamers. And it's like, yeah, that stuff actually happens.
I'm not actually sure.
Oh.
What story we're talking about. Can you?
So, Avillo.
Oh, okay. We can edit out the name.
Yeah. I was like...
Sorry. I think I do know about this. Okay.
Yeah. But it happens a ton. I mean, the same time that guys make the jokes of like, oh, if someone offered me $100 for a picture of my foot, I totally do it. There's also the like, well, you know, if you do that, then that guy's suddenly in love with you and he's going to send you a bunch of pictures and he's going to find out where you live and show up with handcuffs and just kidnap you. And it's like... Yeah. I feel like a lot of people just don't think that far ahead because it's still one of those like, oh, that'll never happen. But it's like for girls, like it's a legitimate thing that I'm afraid of.
Well, I mean, there's just, I mean, just this natural thing is that men tend to be bigger and stronger than women. So I think a lot of men don't appreciate that, like, okay, this actually can be pretty scary.
Yeah.
If like I'm a tall, large guy. I don't generally consider myself in danger. Even in moments where technically I'm doing something that might be dangerous or like I'm in a part of town.
Yeah.
Like, never mind being in Seoul because Seoul's pretty safe. Yeah. It's about as safe as you can get. But I just tend to think I'm probably going to be fine. And,
right.
And I'm just probably not a target for violence necessarily. But yeah, I mean, it's a totally different world.
Yeah.
You have to have all these kind of precautions as you go out there.
Yeah.
Not that the world is inherently dangerous or bad either, but it's you have to also...
Well, yeah. To put it in more like a realistic perspective, right? Because there's going to be, you know, hundreds of people listening to this podcast going like, no, that never Millions happens. Is that let's try and put something that's a little less severe here and say that, you know how you've talked about this, you have to put a boundary up because people seem to know, they think they know us and we have no idea who they are.
It's actually a small number of people, but every once in a while I'll have a kid who just like, I've been nice to him and I've talked to him and I'm actually out with my friends or I'm on a date. And this person just keeps... I had this one guy that kept showing me photos of my brother on his phone. Look, it's your brother. And I go, yeah, man. That's my brother. I know. And then I kind of like try to turn. And then he come back. Look, here's another photo of your brother. I'm like, these are Google image photos of my brother. Like, what are we doing here? In that moment, I actually really did kind of feel like, oh, this must be what it's like if you're like in a club and you're trying to have a good time. You're a woman and you're with your friends and there's just a guy who won't. Fuck off.
Yeah.
You know? And it's just sort of like, okay, well now my entire night is about me trying to dodge this guy.
Yeah, exactly.
Because I don't want to be confrontational or I'm not comfortable with that at that moment.
No one really wants to be confrontational. Like you take away the gender thing and it still comes down to it that no one wants to have to navigate that complex scenario of eventually just being like, look, dude, I don't know you. But it seems to happen especially to women. So, you know, there's that kind of stereotype of a woman on Twitch streams who's very nice. And there'll be a guy that comes in that's literally like, you know, like, wow, your feet smell amazing. And instead of like a probably normal response, just be like, that's fucking weird, dude. The woman's trying to be nice. She's going to be confrontational. She knows that this is a potential viewer, blah, blah, blah. So she goes, oh, you know, I like that's funny. Like, you don't really know. Okay, haha. And she just like lets it go. And then that guy shows up in an actual convention or tournament or something. And suddenly is that guy that just like showing pictures of your brother. But even worse, he just actually wants to follow you everywhere. So the more
I don't think that guy was showing me pictures of my brother who had the intentions of sleeping with me or, you know, something like that. He just doesn't. He's not picking up on a series of cues where it's like,
yes.
Okay, like I've given you my few minutes and now I'm...
And that's the other level exactly as being a woman is that you always like are like, okay, when's it going to come? Like when's the whole like, hey, you want to go on a date going to come? And then you do see these things actually happen and then people just seem to sweep it under the rug where like some chick was on a friend, whatever you want to call it, with one of her subscribers and he like tries to turn the camera off on her. Like he tried to like turn the camera away. It's happened on Twitch.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And... It's like, it happens so easily, actually, to have those type of guys attached to you. And again, like, you know, 99.9% of them are not going to end up being serial killers, of course, or, you know, whatever. But the amount of just like weird people that come to you as a woman is just, I'm going to go ahead and say that it's just drastically higher.
Well, I think it has to be because, excuse me, I'm a little bit congested today. No, it would have to be because even though, like, I'll take myself, I consider myself really social. Like, I can hang out with people. I can be around people for weeks and basically not tire of it. I eventually need to have some alone time, but really, socializing is not hard for me. But I do love playing games all day by myself. I cherish these moments where I'm just alone. All my errands are done. All my stuff is in a row. And so I can really hang out and do that. But there's all sorts of people that are also in gaming for reasons because they maybe can't socialize or can't... you know, there's a lot of stuff they can't do. It's a form of escapism. And then what you have is women who also take an interest. Suddenly, these are guys who probably also haven't been dating. Right? And they're, okay, it's a girl. Because when you think about it, if you're a guy that really plays games all the time, the ideal mate would probably be somebody who plays games all the time, too. Right? And not somebody who doesn't approve of this or doesn't understand you. But then you have people who are just socially not put together, who are coming and bothering you. And the internet's funny in this way that it's brought people to, it's brought everybody together, but a little bit too much. You know, where I love that I can put this podcast out there and I connect with people. And then I can put I can do a show in South Korea and give it to somebody in Sweden or in anywhere in the world. And it's fine and it works. But I guess there's also this weird element where you're suddenly really being pulled close to people where it can be uncomfortable.
Yeah, absolutely. And that happens like man or woman. Like, you know, I've had, like, being around you, actually, I see it, like, literally I could witness these guys kind of getting a little too weird. But but as a woman, it's not even a little more common. It is more common, and it's also a lot more threatening.
Right. Do you think that there is good security at these events?
Ooh, that's a good question. Because
I feel like, well, like, take BlizzCon. BlizzCon, I feel like, is got very good security. I mean, I always feel comfortable. I know nobody's going to come backstage.
Yeah, I never feel like someone's going to come in with a knife.
Right.
But there's nothing they can really do about someone being overpowered. And that's what's scary about it, right?
Right.
I don't know. I actually don't have much of an opinion on the security thing. But I got to imagine it's pretty good.
Yeah, I wonder because there's so many... Here's the thing, though, too. I actually think, for the most part, the world's pretty safe.
Sure.
I think when people talk about how dangerous it is out there, I say, well, actually, I mean, it's a really good time to be alive.
Yes.
You know, we're just more connected now than ever. So there's a whole new weird set of problems. Hey, guys. It's Hungover Tasteless again. This is... we're having a quick break here. Hope you guys have been enjoying this interview. We are taking a short break to thank our Patreon supporters that give us over $100 a month. These are the real heroes, okay? Charlie Sheaver and John Kernicki, I love you guys. And Charlie Sheaver, I haven't seen you in a long time. Hope I see you again. John Kernicki, I'm going to probably be seeing at BlizzCon coming up here. That's Avex, the great map maker. You didn't know that? Ryan didn't know that. So I really appreciate the support, guys. And if you guys can support us, if you like what I'm doing here, I know this is very different from what a lot of other esports people are doing. I know it's not a tournament. I know it's not like me streaming a game, but I'm trying to make something pretty cool here. And it's a way that you can consume something gaming, esports related, whatever it is. You can consume it in a different format. You can listen to it in your car or while you're walking your dog or you're going to the grocery store. So I hope you're enjoying this. If you can, if possible, as I always say, support us on Patreon. That's patreon.com/tastelesspodcast. Is there anything else I need to mention? We good? Should we go back to the podcast? That's good? You know what? Let's go back to that zombie grub conversation. So you started out doing online casting, right? Was that originally a base trade TV?
No, it was not. I started doing casting just, the story goes, like, I was with a friend and we were playing in a small tournament for, like, the prize money was, like, getting coaching by a Masters player, and we lost. So the next week we came in and we saw some guy was casting. We were like, that seems like really fun, maybe we could do a good job. and we took it upon ourselves to cast a tournament, not asking anyone's permission, which is like a no-no, but it was a very small thing, and we didn't think about like taking the guy's job away or anything like that. So the commentator got mad at us, but the tournament organizer actually liked us and asked us to come back. Yeah, and do more commentary. So that's kind of what it got started. And then I kind of got hooked on it as a way to learn StarCraft and then get into like clans and stuff, because I was interested in being like actually getting good at it and being a pro. So I would use commentary as a way to like finagle my way in there and get replays and stuff.
This is literally the same thing for me.
Oh,
I actually just wanted to meet other pro gamers and get replays and get access and watch Koreans play in person.
Yeah, so that's what I did. And I went to a bunch of like clan forums and would apply to be their community caster. And it worked for a couple different teams. And it was like a good learning experience. Eventually, I applied to this thing called the URTL, which was a decent size, like it was called the Underrated Team League. So it had a bunch of, tier two, tier three clans and teams, and I applied to be a caster and I got in. That's where I met Fear Dragon, actually. So this was back in 2011, and that was like my first big gig. So it was like 1,000 people maybe on a good day per match, but still like a decent amount. And that was consistent enough too that I actually got into it. I kind of got known to be a commentator. Around this time I was also on like StarCraft Strategy, which was a team that had Neeb on it. Actually, that's where I met Neeb, although very briefly. And I was trying to be really good at the game, but then my wrist issues started up, and I just never really had the diligence to practice enough, even though I made masters and all that. So I just picked up more and more commentary because I couldn't play the game, and more people were starting to actually ask me to do commentary as well. So eventually, my first big breakout was on the MLG community cast, which again, back then, like you would get 5,000 viewers for 3 brand new Twitch streams. It was actually pretty good. So Axletos and Axlav were like, they really liked my casting, and they put me on a team with a couple of people that I knew and worked well with. And that's when I got like my first big break. Everyone thought I was Scarlet, of course, like the only only woman voice allowed.
Yeah.
And they all thought I was really good. And I got a couple of shout outs from a couple of the other commentators in the scene, because I brought my cat Apollo on. This is when he was like a little kitten. That was my downtime content. And actually, one of the Korean commentators was watching and like took a screen cap of it. And of course, I screenshotted that into my like my memoir books.
Yeah.
To see like see him tweet about me. So that gave me an in to do DreamHack community casting, which was on my channel. So I'd bring in co-casters that I liked working with. So I did that a couple times, and then my official connection, I guess, to like the big guys in choosing casters would be WCS Europe. I don't even know what to call it anymore, right? Because 6 years ago, Challenger and qualifiers were so different.
Oh, yeah. No, it was a totally different...
Yeah.
It was operating in an entirely different way.
Exactly. But it was basically WCS Europe. Challenger, it was online. It was me, Penguin, Maddles, and like one or two other people. And I was consistently on there. And that was actually like a lot of people would watch that. So that's where most people like initially found out who I was. And it was around that exact same time where Rifkin had messaged me to do a Go for StarCraft, I believe, finals with him. And it was the second time he messaged me, and I was one of many. Just he was desperate to get a co-caster, and I was the only one that responded. So that's how we did our first cast together. And apparently the community really liked it, so they asked me to come back on. And that's around the same time that I started doing more and more work for Base Trade TV.
What was it like to go from doing online casting to eventually getting flown somewhere to do a live event? Because I mean, the whole setup is totally different. The fact that, you might be in your room doing an online cast and suddenly you're in front of an audience.
Yeah, that's, it's a little muddled, right? Because Base Trade TV actually made, their own tournament, Hell It's Boot Time. So, and I also, because Axel...
Did you say Hell It's a Boot Time?
Yeah,
it's Canadian?
It's, okay. It was in Canada, exactly.
I'll make sure I got that.
That was my first like gig I was doing the entire weekend in front of a crowd. But my first experience was actually Axletos liked me so much, they invited me to do a community cast of IEM New York in their studio at MLG. Gosh, 2012 was so different. And that was my first online broadcast actually. So I kind of had the experience with like the lights and the, you know, the flashing buttons and the official headset and stuff there, which I think I did a pretty poor job at, but people were nice.
Were you nervous?
Oh yeah, I was totally nervous.
It's totally weird. When yeah. They're like, okay, 5, 4,
yeah.
3. And then you're live, you're like, oh my God, I'm going out here. Okay.
Well, and for me, like the thing that I always worried about most was how I appeared. You know, when I first did commentary and I was forced to use a webcam even, I was really nervous and I didn't want to. Not just because like, oh man, it's a woman, but just like I very low self-confidence. So when I was forced to go like actually on like actual camera, I was just so nervous and I thought I looked so dumb. And but people were really nice, in control, even like that was the first time like he seemed to like acknowledge me and he said I did a really good job. And it was like I was like over the moon. And that's when I guess I really started to love the idea of being a commentator, because that's basically everyone's goal when they start doing commentary. Even if they're doing it as a hobby, no one would turn down, you know, WCS, IEM, NASL, whatever it was back then, job, because it feels so amazing to be in that official studio with a really professional co-caster, and then the crowd when you can hear it is also amazing. So I had all these like kind of like halfway experiences, right? There was that. There was Hell It's a Boot Time. I did a Home Story Cup cast. Then we did a couple other things. And then Nation Wars was the first time that I was like officially flown out. Like they paid for my flight.
That
they
was
paid
in Paris,
me.
Right?
Yeah, exactly. That was the first time. And I was really nervous. But the thing is that I think this is true for a lot of people. And Artosis says the same thing. But like, when I start talking about StarCraft, I forget that I'm nervous about myself. You know, I'm not going to come in here and say I was the best public speaker ever when I was in high school. No, I was definitely one of the shy nerds who didn't want to go up in front of the class. But through knowing what I was talking about with StarCraft, I gained more confidence. And now I can go up in front of a crowd of people and talk about things I don't even know. So as soon as I started casting StarCraft, I just relaxed and I wasn't nervous. And that was a pretty successful first gig.
Was it difficult for you to adjust to working with a crew? I mean, there's also a lot of different types of crews. I've worked with some absolute dumpster fire production sets, and I've worked with ones where I'm like, wow, these are like the best in the world. But is that weird? Because I know when you're doing a cast from your home, you really are sort of in total control.
Yeah.
No one's going to come over and tell you, hey, Zombie Grub, don't do that. Or we're actually going to do this. Or you don't get nitpicked as much.
Yeah, you certainly don't. I mean, we certainly, like, you know, I had discussions with Rifkin, who's the person I cast with, you know, for the longest amount of time, about, you know, how to present the cast. But actually, Nation Wars was, like, this perfect introduction thing because it was so casual. I mean, Nation Wars was 2 or 3 years ago kind of almost at the same level as, like, Home Story Cup in a lot of ways, right? Like, you were just totally casual. You came in T-shirts. I mean, we weren't drunk. We weren't drinking on the on the casting desk. But it, you know, probably wouldn't even been that bad if we had. It would have been just like a fun thing to do. So there was really no notes. Basically, the only note I think we got was like play with the camera more. So that's why we started like doing like finger guns to the camera and stuff. And that was basically was just like have fun. And that was already something that you're very comfortable with.
I've always found those casts to be better when people are just actually having fun.
Yeah.
Do you feel like I guess would you agree like? I like the way FGC casting is a lot of times where it's like they're having fun, they're hype. I think some of the profanity I would probably just avoid because I don't think it helps that much. But I like the vibe of FGC casting more. I've always felt it's a better product until you're in the finals. And then when you're in the finals, it's got to be all hype.
Okay.
You know, I try not to goof around during that as much. But sorry, go ahead.
Well, I do think a lot about commentary styles and how to be like a better commentator and all that stuff. So I watch other video games to learn that. So I was watching the International, even though I don't really like Dota that much. And I will say that I really like the casualness of the fighting game community. I think the pacing of their commentary is overall just worse. Like, I'm going to come in here as a StarCraft like elitist for sure and say that StarCraft is the best pacing for commentary. That you can kind of have that time to joke around and have the exposition and also have the hype moments and also have the analyst.
But isn't that the way that StarCraft is made? StarCraft is built to tell stories in, whereas I think like fighting game stuff, I mean, I actually think occasionally they rush along a little bit too fast, like at Evo. Uh-huh. Like I'm sometimes I'm just shocked and how quickly they're swapping the players off and on the stage. Yeah. I guess they get a lot of good game time, but I always think, oh, there's so much more you could do here with
Absolutely.
A stage or with B-roll or hype or mm-hmm. you know, stats and stuff like that. But I've always found that StarCraft, just the way that it flows, allows for, I guess, more elegant commentary, more story building, more packaging in a certain way. Whereas I think fighting games, a lot of time you're trying to sum up the meta, the history of the two players, and then you have two guys reacting and trying to get a read.
Yeah.
The same time these two players are trying to get a read on each other, the commentators are, as experts, are trying to get a read on what's going on in this fight
mm-hmm.
and translate it to the viewer.
And that's absolutely the case. I think fighting games are really unique in that, you know, League of Legends, Dota, CSGO, I think we've all kind of adopted a similar structure of way we do things. And depending on the budget and the amount of commentators you have, you can do like more analyst stuff or have different desks and all that. But fighting games is still, I guess, very like low production, really. Like the amount of people working and coordinating is insane because there's so many things happening. But in terms of like actually looking at the finished product, it's not the same as looking at, you know, the NAFL, which or the NFL, which actually is like, you could compare Overwatch League to that. Like, it's very polished. It kind of sums up those stories in a nice little package. But fighting game communities are just like, okay, we're like here to commentate this game, and we're talking about the story, and talking about the players, and then we're done. Okay, here we're talking about another game, and their player, and their story. Like, just bing, bang, boom.
What is your take on Overwatch League and the way they do it?
I think it's very, very polished sometimes to the point of being a little boring. Like, they are very... It's kind of clear that they are... what's the word, like, I'm trying to think of like a nice way to put this too, but like that their whole goal is to look as professional as possible and to promote themselves to these very big sponsors, right?
Right.
To appeal to as many people as possible. There
it seems like the safest attempt.
Yeah, it's a little
anything.
Sanitized.
It's so sanitized.
Yeah, exactly.
From head to toe.
Right.
They are absolutely, I mean, for whatever, I understand the goals here, but concerned about possibly offending anybody or crossing any boundaries.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, and that might be best for them. I don't know. I mean, what I prefer is watching, you know, cool fighting game tournaments and very real commentary. Same with StarCraft. I mean, that's what we try to have fun in GSLs. We're trying to really
mm-hmm.
kind of celebrate the game with the viewers.
And that's, again, like one of the things where I think that StarCraft, either 2 or Brood War, really hits that just perfect balance. That's why I like watching and commenting it the most. Like, we do have the whole like just idea that there's a bunch of friends talking about StarCraft, but they can do it in a professional way as well as a fun way, and we have the time to do it as well, both in the game as well as for the analyst segments. Which the only thing I would say is that like my one critique would be for StarCraft stuff is that we don't really expand on the analysis stuff a lot because we are also kind of getting into that next game, right? Downtime is bad.
Yeah,
time.
The analysis desk is a weird thing because it's essentially a filler.
Yeah.
It is simply there to create content and not have a slide up that's counting down from, you know, 25
yeah, yeah.
minutes until we're ready to go in the game. And so it's hard to... Also, so many of these tournaments, they get behind schedule. I mean, this happens where it's like the first two best of fives, they took 5 hours. That wasn't anticipated, but it took...
Right.
And now we're, you know, there's all these other problems where, okay, well, this venue, technically, we're not legally allowed to be in at midnight.
Yeah.
So we need to power through this. We might have to figure this out when we get there. And so I think in moments like that, that's why you see limited amounts of B-roll, because otherwise we have content that was made for and paid for that we can't put out.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. I mean, to go on like the opposite side of, you know, what we're talking about now is like Dota. They went from a desk with a host like Red Eye, for instance, and then they went to these, I thought were the commentators at first. They were like, okay, we're heading over to blank, blank, and blank. You know, it's three people around a small table, and they were actually the draft analysis commentators. Like, that was their job. And then they went to the actual commentators, and I was like,
it's like one of those Final Fantasy bosses where you keep thinking it's the final form and you're not sure if you're finally there yet.
No, that's exactly what it was like the first time that I watched it. And then once I understood it, I was like, okay, I get it. Like, drafts are very important in these types of games. But that's when I'm like, I think Dota, but this is what their community likes, so I can't even be, you know, I can't really judge, but they love analysts so much more than like their play-by-plays and stuff.
Well, I think what happens with Dota specifically is that it's almost like you have like those guys are doing the picks, the pick ban commentary. That's like two chemists trying to explain how these characters are going to interact or how they could interact, depending on what's going on here. Because there's so much to the game that is just that, that you can end up in the game and talk about what happened, but it's almost more important or as important to go back and try to get this there as well. I also think that that might be a smart move to give commentators and casters more time to rest in between, because I think only just now are the publishers and organizers really starting to kind of figure out, okay, how much camera time is too much? Even if some people can do it better than others, what is realistically going to bring the most likely best product here?
Mm-hmm. That juggling like that they have to do in general for that is actually very interesting, right? Like, Overwatch League does it so that there are one pair of casters has the slot there, the match for that day, and that's 4 days, I believe, a week. So they know four series they'll cast, and they'll just prep for those four series, right? So, but that can't really happen in StarCraft. Like, you guys at GSL kind of have that as well, which is nice. But for a weekend event, for instance, that just won't happen. So you have this thing where you, like, it's a lot about money a lot of the time.
Yeah.
But also is also a question of, like, how much screen time is good? How much do we want to use each of these? Like, what is our goal with the product, right? All these questions come up when you're actually developing a tournament. But, you know, we're down to five commentators per event right now for, like, WCS. And it's like, that means we get a lot of time to try and work our magic and appeal to people. But it also means that we can't study, you know, individual matches. And we can't be, like, the go-to person for this person. Like, we actually kind of have to do all the jobs, including being both a play-by-play person and an analyst person, because there's not always enough commentators to go around and always fit play-by-play with analysis.
Also, compared to a normal sports production, there's way less put in as far as, like, we don't have writers, we don't have statisticians.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I know when I was trying to get GSL, they kept saying, we don't have the budget. You don't have any writers. And I said, no. I said, just don't hire anything. Anybody. Just Dan and me, and then let the cameras roll. We don't even need a producer if you don't want. Just have someone who hits buttons and this, you know, track our voices onto it. And we still don't have writers. I mean, there's writers for the Koreans, and if we really needed something, we can get it from them. But obviously nobody writes our jokes or analysis or anything like that. They'll occasionally give us some stat sheets if there's a really extraordinary statistic, but this is something that I'm curious if it's going to be sorted later on in esports, because a lot of times people don't appreciate how much the casters are actually doing almost everything.
Right.
I mean, obviously there's still cameramen and sound people and stuff that, but normally when you do a show, there's actually a lot more, I guess, help.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've done shows also where there's people that are there for quote-unquote help and they're not helpful, and that's really stressful too, and you have somebody kind of micromanaging you in a weird way that just doesn't allow you to do anything that's going to make the show better.
Yeah. Well, there's just, like, different styles of that as well. Like, everything could be top tier in terms of, like, you know, the food you get and the amount of attention that you get, and your job is very specific. But then if the producer is very, like, hands-on, that's actually just something that probably wouldn't work that well in StarCraft, right? That just gets more into the sanitizing of things usually. We get kind of more aggravated, I think, compared to, like, I feel like I hear about League of Legends commentators for the non-Korean stuff, at least, because I don't know much about the Korean League of Legends scene, that they're, you know, definitely, like, more hands-on. Like, they get a lot of attention from Riot, right? And they have to kind
of... Yeah, they have a lot of control over them. And direction, and I mean, for better or for worse, right? I mean,
right.
I think in some cases, people actually need that. I've definitely watched some tournaments where I think someone needs to get over here and tell these casters, you know,
what to do.
Not so much in StarCraft, but I watch a lot of esports, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And then there's other times where, in my own experience, you have too many people meddling with you. And ultimately, like, when the cameras turn on, I'm just going to start talking. There's only so much help I could possibly be given, or guidance or adjustments that I can make. As long as I'm comfortable, I can probably do something that's going to be good. But it is a balancing act.
It absolutely is. I mean, to have someone like... Because, you know, apparently if you go to actual studios, like newscasters' rooms, right? Apparently the person in your ear just, like, talks nonstop. And you, like, have to, like, pay attention to so many things. It's a little bit different,
though, because for that, they're constantly giving you live
information. Yeah, absolutely. It is different.
So you start to kind of master, okay, there's a hurricane in Florida. We're going to go to that right now. And also, if you watch, like, a news broadcast, right, they have tons of commercials.
Mm-hmm.
It's insane. there's almost as many commercials as there is show.
Yes.
So it's like they basically come together, scramble, set everything up, put everybody together, run through it, take it down.
Yeah.
But I think in a lot of esports casting, it's sort of like you're trying to keep a spaceship afloat in outer space. We just can't have the show fall apart because there's going to be all this downtime and there's going to be technical difficulties. A pro gamer might be complaining about, you know, the desk that he's at, and then we have to fill for 20 more minutes.
Yeah.
So it's more about trying to keep it not cringy and comfortable.
Yeah, it's definitely like a lot more freestyling. But the point is that, you know, especially for StarCraft, as soon as we start commentating, basically no one really talks to us.
Yeah, thank God.
Yeah, exactly. Where I feel like, I think there's definitely other scenes that have a problem.
Do you know which one? Does League actually do that?
That's the only thing I can even think of.
I know that they'll cue them to go to the highlight video, but I feel like that makes sense. You know, when they have
cues are, you know, definitely make sense.
Cues are just, yeah.
For sure. But to have someone that, like, not even necessarily talking in your ear all the time, but, and again, like, to you said this, like, it's both a strength and a potential problem, is that we also don't have anyone come between casts and talk to us. You know, like, there's no one to come to us and be like, hey, the way that you presented that commentary was not exactly what we had in mind. Like, that basically never happens. And that's, you know,
do you think that's good or bad?
Well, sometimes I think that it could be bad, right? Like, I think it's not, you know, it's not that shocking to hear that there's sometimes problems with, like, co-commentators, right? Like, sometimes something just, they're off that day, or
one person's talking over the other one, or
And then, you know, you want to have the maturity to be able to be like, hey, like, this is kind of a problem. But it also comes to sometimes a point where it's like, well, you know, can it also be the producer's job, so that when we next have to cast, I don't have to awkwardly, like, think that I ruined your day or something like that.
Yeah, I see what you're saying.
Yeah. So, but, like, no one comes to us between games. And again, I think right now it's great, because I think StarCraft II's quality of commentary is actually fantastic. So a lot of it is that we are doing the right thing most of the time. But also, I think right now,
if you had a new game or something, there might need to be a little bit more.
Yeah, because the direction would just be, I mean, totally different. I mean, StarCraft's commentary started kind of with you guys out here in Korea. You kind of set the tone that ended up working perfectly, but you went to a new game, and then you, depending on how much money gets invested into it as well, right? Like, you want a different product than what StarCraft might be doing or fighting games might be doing.
It's also what the sponsors and the publishers are comfortable with. And it seems like a lot of times they're trying to avoid anything stereotypical gamer, which is also, it can become lame in a different way. But it is always like a balancing act, you know?
Yeah.
I've always found, for me, if I get micromanaged too much in between sets, I just start to, like, not know what I'm doing. I start to second guess myself. But there's also been moments where I think it's definitely helped people too. I think it just kind of depends.
Yeah. Well, also, you know, actually, I think of one problem that existed where I wasn't micromanaged at all. This was a general kind of like, I like this thing, and I paid attention when this guy was talking. And so I you know, internalized. I was like, okay, he likes when I do that thing. I'm going to keep doing it more. So I was actually told to be more... what's the word? Like, have disagreeing opinions on the desk. Like, I was actually told that was something that our producer
liked.
That can
lead to a lot of problems.
Sure, it can. Yeah. But the thing is that I remember I was told this along with, like, Maynard, for instance. So for Leipzig, we kind of played off the Showtime Namshart thing, where I was, like, the stats person. I was like, no, Showtime's got this. No way he's going to lose. And Maynard was more of the, like, no, I believe in my boy Namshar. And I remembered that was something that, you know, the product, the show wanted. So I did it with Fear Dragon once, and I forgot to tell him that this...
Like, why are you throwing me under the bus, Zombie Grub? All these people are watching.
Well, where I was just like, I remember I was like telling him, because we were choosing between two players in Montreal, and I was like, you know what? I'm going to go really hard on this choice. You can go really hard on that choice. It's going to be great. And at the time, Fear Dragon was just like, oh yeah, okay, sure. I was going to do that anyways. Like, I was going to choose that guy. But I just didn't realize, like, it was like 5 months later, I'm talking to him about how, yeah, I was told, like, we should disagree, like, pretty strongly more. And he was like, oh, that's why you did that thing once. And I was like, oh, yeah, like, that just not, like, you weren't told the same thing, and apparently not. But I'm also, like, I see now sometimes the critique of my commentary sometimes was like, oh, she just disagrees with her co-casters too much. And I was like, Where does this come from? That's a weird one.
Well, there's also a problem with trying to get too much feedback from the internet.
Well, yes.
Because, I mean, there's periods where I've said something wrong or Dan said something wrong. And I have the choice to say, no. No, Dan, it's not like that at all. No, it's actually this. Or I can just go, or it's like this or that. Or, you know, or ignore the mistake and then transition out of it to make it not uncomfortable. And, but, like, I'll give you an example. About every month, either Dan or me will get some long, either it's a series of like 10 tweets or it's a DM of a person telling us that, don't worry if Tasteless is so mean to you, or don't worry if Artosis is so mean to you.
Yeah.
I see you being bullied. I know what it's like to be bullied. And you don't have to take this. And I'm just, and the thing is, like, for Dan and me, there is never a moment in the last, I mean, in years, that I think you could ever, that there was ever any off-air tension that bubbled up on air.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it just, but people will see this, or they'll see us making jokes at each other.
Right.
Or, you know, one of us feels more analytical that day, or whatever it is. But there's always this thing where people will watch this and start to see drama where there's not drama.
Yes.
And it's very fucking weird. I get it, though. I actually totally get it. You can have a whole bunch of different people see the same interaction completely differently. But it is fascinating.
Yeah.
Because with the internet being a public place, someone can post this complaint about you or critique or whatever they think it is. And then you have people that never even saw the cast chiming in, or that's then colored their opinions.
Right.
I mean, I think the late in control, Jeff Robinson, was constantly getting targeted by this. I think he looked like a lot of the kind of the bully or the jock. I mean, he did not look like a gamer. And so people would then come after him saying, I know what you're doing. I think, no, there was never really any problem that anybody had, you know, with Jeff. Everybody actually appreciated how funny made the show look.
Mm-hmm.
But somehow you had a group of people that just didn't see it that way.
Yeah.
Or were uncomfortable or were threatened by it.
Yeah. And that, like, it can be a scary thing to have that direction, right? You know, going back to the original topic, is to have that direction, whatever it is, and then present yourself as that want, when maybe you yourself aren't necessarily that type of person, or you might come off looking bad, right? Like, maybe you disagreed with someone, but you didn't do it, you know, joyfully enough. So it actually came off like you were, like, straight up disagreeing. So, like, there's just so many things that can be thought about when it goes into commentary. But for that specific thing, I actually was like, those are like the two instances I remember pushing the disagreement. Otherwise, I think I'm actually very agreeable, like, on the actual desk. But it is just like a one or two moments that seem to really stick in people's minds, right?
Yeah.
Then it's really hard to get rid of. They could watch two casts of you, pick up on something that you do, like, oh, she has bad ProDOS knowledge or whatever, as an example. And then you could spend a year improving your ProDOS knowledge, and it would take an entire year to convince that same person that you actually got better.
Yeah, judgment's been made.
Exactly.
It is an odd thing to forums and stuff like that in general, where it's like, this is so public. Anybody with an internet, the internet can come on there and just read this. And
yeah,
a lot of times there's no, I personally am not of the belief that you respond to threads. I just don't. A lot of times I don't even read them, but it is a very kind of unique and weird thing. We're actually getting a little bit short on time here, but what is coming up for you down the road? Do you have any other gigs you're doing? I know you're flying back. Mm-hmm. You're flying back home on Thursday, right?
Correct. Yeah. Flying back home on Thursday, so I'll be doing the last Banshee tournament on that Saturday for the foreseeable future, and they'll be heading off to Montreal to commentate. It's not announced, but I assume that it will be before this is out.
We'll find out.
Yeah, so you'll see me there, and then that's actually kind of the most that I know for sure to have happen, so we'll see what the future holds.
I look forward to it. Thank you so much for doing this. I know you're on holiday down here, so I appreciate you coming down here and hanging out with me and doing this podcast.
It's a great honor to be on the Tasteless podcast, man.
All right, guys. That does it for the Zombie Grub interview. I'm really grateful she was able to come onto the show. I know she was out here on vacation, so it was very cool of her to come hang out here at my place and have that conversation. Send her some love on Twitter. And thank you for listening to another episode. What was this, episode 10, guys? Episode 11. Only 11 episodes, guys, and the Tasteless podcast is crushing it. And we're not stopping. I've got another interview already recorded. I've got a few other people around the corner. So we're going to keep cranking this out again. Usually every other week, occasionally if I get enough stored up, like in the bank, I'll start to release them more quickly. But I'm trying to make sure this is consistent as possible. So, guys, thank you so much for joining me. As usual, blah, 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 blah. Tasteless podcast at Patreon. That's patreon.com/tastelesspodcast if you can support us. It's really appreciated. And I will see you guys again soon. This podcast was produced by Melty and State. The artwork was by Alarise. She does a very excellent job. The music was by Mark Lentz, who's a very cool guy. I miss you, Mark. I hope I get to see you. He's in Japan now. And thank you guys for joining us. Again, we're going to keep trying to make something fucking cool here. So keep joining us here at the Tasteless Podcast. I love you guys. Take care of yourselves. Have a good one. Bye-bye.